Our next case for argument this morning is United States against Collins. Ms. Pavlov.
May it please the court, counsel. In this case, the jury was told that Keith Collins was a gun-toting drug dealer who sold drugs every other day. And this prohibited the jury from making an independent determination of whether he was involved in a drug conspiracy on January 24th. The evidence of the gun is unrelated. The evidence showed that it was properly registered. Mr. Collins had a FOID card for it. It was found in his home, and when they conducted the search of his home and found that gun, there was no cocaine recovered. It was not used by the district court to enhance his base offense level. And in fact, the evidence showed that it was used to shoot rats in the alley. It was not used to transport or obtain any cocaine, as evidenced by the fact that on the date of his arrest, he was not in possession of a gun. It wasn't in his car. It wasn't in Ms. Johnson's car. The gun is simply unrelated. Also unrelated is evidence of other drug transactions. Ms. Johnson testified that she observed him sell cocaine every other day. She was unable to put any type of specific time frame reference on this, but most importantly, it's unrelated to the conspiracy because the conspiracy is between Mr. Collins, Ms. Johnson, and Mr. McNeil. Based on Ms. Johnson's testimony, it's clear that she's not involved in these every other day sales, and there's certainly no evidence that he obtained these drugs from Mr. McNeil or that Mr. McNeil had any participation in it. And certainly hearing just the sheer fact that he is a drug dealer or that he possessed a gun severely prejudiced him in receiving a trial on the merits of January 24th. There was also a motion to suppress that was litigated in this case. The district court made a finding that there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Collins, and that probable cause determination hinged on Agent Warren's credibility and whether he saw what he saw. There were some photographs that he took, and specifically he testified that he saw crack cocaine in Mr. Collins' hand through the lens of the photographs that are depicted in the record, and I've included two in the appendix. And the reason is Agent Warren said that he saw the bag of crack cocaine between photographs 138 and 137, and they're actually, the photos were taken in descending numerical order. Even looking at the distance that's in these photographs, it's simply impossible to determine that he held a bag of crack cocaine for mere seconds. You're looking at the photos and you couldn't even make a positive identification of the person in the photograph. The only reason we know it's Mr. Collins is because they watched this person get in a vehicle and stop the vehicle immediately. In taking into account his credibility, there's a few things to consider. He testified that he saw crack cocaine. Again, looking at the photographs, it's impossible to determine the texture of an item from that distance. He had a hunch, and the fact that the hunch may have turned out to be correct or did turn out to be correct doesn't vitiate the need for probable cause before he makes that arrest. He also had some other areas where his credibility was impugned. He indicated he was less than 50 yards away in his vehicle conducting surveillance. He was at the southeast corner of Division and Menard watching this. That distance is actually closer to 88 yards, about 266 feet. He was off by well over 100 feet, and I would simply suggest that you can consider that in deciding, one, either his powers of observation or the fact that he just completely misstated the distance. I've also indicated in my brief that there was a sentencing issue. At the time that Mr. Collins was sentenced, there was an issue raised regarding the crack cocaine powder disparity. At the time, the court indicated it could not consider that disparity. Since the time of the sentencing, of course, the Supreme Court has issued the Kimbrough opinion, which does allow for a district court to consider that in imposing sentence. The government has conceded in its brief that a remand for resentencing is appropriate, and we ask that you do so. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Roman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court did not commit plain error when it admitted the firearms evidence. As the court is well aware, because trial counsel failed to make this objection to the admission of the firearms evidence, as the record indicates, the claims are forfeited and are reviewed for plain error. This is an extremely high burden to meet, and it has not been met in this case. There was no error in admitting the firearms evidence because that evidence was directly relevant to the charged conspiracy. The defendant has to make the extremely difficult showing that the evidence was so obviously and egregiously prejudicial that the trial court should have excluded it even without any request from the defense, and that no reasonable person could argue for its admissibility. The indictment charged that as part of the conspiracy, two individuals, Keith Collins and Gregory McNeil, knowingly possessed firearms while storing, transporting, and preparing crack cocaine and crack cocaine in order to provide security for their drug trafficking operation. As this court has recognized on several instances, guns are tools of the drug trade. The evidence in question showed how Keith Collins protected and controlled his drug trafficking operation. It should be remembered that in his confession, which came in through the testimony of the DEA agent, William Warren, Collins said that he had been buying crack cocaine for money, also known as Gregory McNeil, for approximately 4 to 6 months. This is on page 109 of the transcript. There was no unfair prejudice to Collins by the admission of this evidence. The prejudicial impact of this evidence, as the court knows, is measured according to the extent to which the jury might consider that evidence for purposes other than that for which it was intended. The defendant cannot meet that standard of prejudice here. The evidence in this case, as the record reflects amply, is that the government did not focus solely on the guns found in the home. In fact, there was a plethora of other evidence, a mountain of evidence, if you will, about the defendant's participation in the charged conspiracy. Most importantly, the defendant's own confession, Rokisha Johnson, his girlfriend's testimony about that conduct, and of course the surveillance and the arrest of January 24th. I would also ask the court to recognize that there was only a very limited reference to guns in the closing argument. It is the reference that is cited in the defense brief, and that is the argument about, quote, tools of the trade. In light of the overwhelming evidence of guilt on count one, the defendant cannot simply meet the burden, which is extremely high, of plain error review. Turning now to the second argument of evidence of other drugs. The court reviews evidence that's admitted over a foundation objection, because that is the objection that was made in this case, for an abuse of discretion. There was no abuse of discretion in the district court's rulings. The prior drug transactions which we're talking about and which Rokisha Johnson testified to occurred during the time frame charged in the indictment and are entirely relevant to the charged conduct. The record reflects that the indictment charged a drug conspiracy that spanned from at least in or about August of 2002 through on or about January 24th of 2003, and that conspiracy involved three individuals, Rokisha Johnson, this defendant, and Gregory McNeil. And evidence of Collins's drug dealing during that time frame, during the period in which he dated a co-defendant who then became a government cooperator, is directly relevant because she saw him sell crack cocaine to others in exchange for money during that time frame. In fact, she said that she saw the defendant selling drugs every other day when she dated him. Additionally, Collins's confession dates back to the expanded time frame. He said that he cooked the crack cocaine and he used money, but it's Gregory McNeil, with him for 4 to 6 months. And that is the charged time frame. Collins' sales during this time frame are directly relevant of the charged conspiracy.
That's true whether or not Johnson was actively involved in the conspiracy at that point. Is that your approach?
Yes. It goes.
She came in later.
She comes in actually prior to the conspiracy. She dates him for 6 months. I believe she started in June. She calls it the summer.
Okay, but the dating isn't the conspiracy,
right? So, correct. It's during the time frame of the conspiracy.
When is she actually involved in the conspiracy from the government's view of the evidence?
I don't know the precise date, but she uses the word summer, and that's June. That's how it was argued at trial.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
With respect to the motion to suppress, Your Honor, the district court's credibility determination, as the court knows, is reviewed for clear error. And here the judge in the case did not credit exceedingly improbable testimony. In fact, the record supports the credibility finding. There was a firm foundation for this finding, and I would ask the court to recognize that Agent Warren saw approximately 673 grams of crack cocaine. We're not talking about a dime bag. We're talking about a mass of cocaine from the vantage point that he was at. And as the record reflects, beginning on page 23 of his suppression testimony, what he saw in the defendant's hands and what the photos themselves reflect is very important to this credibility determination. Keith Collins left Money's home with a brown paper bag. That's on page 23. Photo 138, which the defendant referred to, contains an image of the paper bag. And we're not talking about a small paper bag. We're talking about an actual large shopping bag, one that has handles, and you can see that clearly in the photograph. It's a big bag. The testimony of Agent Warren indicates that Mr. Collins walked to Rokisha Johnson's Mustang car and she was waiting inside. He opened the passenger door, he leaned in, and this is reflected in the photographs, and he stood there for approximately 1 minute in total. During that time frame, Collins began putting the paper bag, which also contained another bag, the plastic bag, which Agent Warren testified that he saw that morning. This is what takes place between photos 138 and 137. Agent Warren described the plastic bag as, quote, an industrial-sized freezer bag, on page 24. And it's important to recognize that an industrial-sized freezer bag is a large bag. It's approximately a foot by foot.
I suppose it depends what industry you're in, but go ahead.
Certainly, Your Honor. A standard freezer bag, though, in this case, would be approximately a foot. And it's important to recognize that that bag contained, as I said before, 673 grams of crack cocaine. Not a dime bag. It's a large bag. It's a mass of cocaine. The lack of a photograph does not adversely affect Agent Warren's credibility. He tried to take a photograph. This is between photograph 138 and 137, but unfortunately the precise moment was not captured. On page 53 of the May 10, 2004 transcript of the suppression ruling, the district court recognized that Agent Warren had to click the shutter to take photographs. He was using a conventional camera, not a digital camera. He was not using a video camera either. The court recognized that the timings of events that day were very quick. This is a drug deal. Things are happening fast. And out of necessity, given the events, Agent Warren was taking photographs. He was also looking through binoculars, and he was making contact over two radios to other law enforcement officers. As he testified, it was, quote, a matter of seconds, and it, quote, happened within a matter of seconds. The district court appreciated this timing. It takes but seconds to put a bag in a car, especially if, as in this case, Mr. Collins wished to limit the exposure of that bag and its contents to others who might be watching. The court also found that it was not implausible, and it is important that the court recognized that Agent Warren was credible, and the government respectfully submits that this court should defer to the district court, which had the opportunity to review and observe the demeanor of Agent Warren and other witnesses when it made its suppression ruling. With respect to the probable cause issue, there were many facts supporting probable cause that morning. First, as the suppression transcript reflects, Agent Warren had received information from at least two confidential informants. The first informant that is talked about in the record and in his testimony indicated that he had bought crack cocaine from Money at 1222 North Menard, which was the house that was under surveillance. The informant identified where Money lived, and the informant stated that Money, who has since been identified as Gregory McNeil, mixed crack cocaine with an individual who had the first name of Keith. The informant identified that the black Dodge pickup, which Mr. Collins drove, and he gave its license plate number, and he indicated that he saw Mr. Collins arrive at Mr. McNeil's address, 1222 North Menard, on at least four instances in recent days on that in using that pickup. The second informant indicated that an individual named Money sold crack cocaine. The court was cognizant that the drug investigation had established several key facts which corroborated the informants. Suffice it to say, Collins was seen coming and going to McNeil's home that morning. Collins was seen entering the home without a bag. He was seen then leaving with a bag, which he then placed into Johnson's Mustang. And in addition, Agent Warren had also determined that the Dodge Ram pickup that the informant had indicated was in front of 1222 North Menard was, in fact, registered to somebody with the first name of Keith, actually Keith Collins. In totality, all of these things support the court's credibility finding, and there was no clear error in that finding.
How could somebody tell the texture of what was in that bag from 250 feet away?
Well, Your Honor, that is Agent Warren's testimony, that he was able to see using a camera and a zoom lens. It's important to recognize he's not saying it was with his naked eye. He's looking through an implement which gave him visibility from a distance, and he was able to see. And you can look at these photographs and see various details of the bags in question. As I began by saying a few moments ago, the photograph in 138 shows a large bag. You can almost read the words on that bag. And Agent Warren was, of course, looking through the zoom lens and the binoculars alternatively, but he was able to tell that it was, in fact, a mass of cocaine through a clear industrial-sized freezer bag. Not a small bag, as I mentioned before. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, the government would respectfully ask that the court affirm the conviction and remand for the limited issue of sentencing, which we raised in the brief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roman. Anything further, Ms. Pavlo?
I respectfully disagree with counsel that when you look at these photographs, you could somehow almost make out the words on the bag. You simply can't.
Well, we can look at them.
I understand that Agent Warren was looking through a telephoto lens, but the photos show what he saw through the lens. And I think in looking through that, you can't see texture. And the fact that he wasn't able to photograph the shot, he's got the camera to his eye, and he didn't photograph it. Now, the district court indicated that doesn't mean he didn't see what he saw, but it also doesn't mean he saw what he saw. Both propositions are equally plausible.
The only problem you've got with this is the credibility determination determined by the court.
I understand, Your Honor. But I think that the factual determination by the court, respectfully, was clearly erroneous because it is simply from that distance to determine that was crack cocaine.
And he said he did, and the judge believed him.
I would say that, respectfully, that's clear error because when you're looking at this vantage point through these photographs, he had a hunch, and it was a correct hunch, but that's not probable cause. You couldn't make an identification based on these photos.
Wow.
And in terms of the informant information that counsel brought up, you know, first of all, the second informant number two, had no information about Mr. Collins. And with regard to informant number one, he gave some general comments that a black Dodge pickup truck was driven by someone named Keith. The agents confirmed that a truck registered to someone named Keith Collins was parked outside McNeil's home. But Agent Warren also indicated that he had no idea what Keith Collins looked like. It was his assumption, I believe is what he testified to at the hearing, that that's who came out of the house. He indicated that he certainly did not have enough probable cause to get any type of warrant or make any arrest at that point. And also, counsel commented on the indictment regarding the gun issue. The indictment does span a time frame of August 2002 to January 2003, but there's no evidence that a gun was used to store or transport drugs. The gun was found in his home. Cocaine was not found in his home. On the day of his arrest, when there are drugs involved, there is no gun. So I'm uncertain what purpose the gun has. Why mention it? Why have two witnesses talk about it if it's not going to prejudice Mr. Collins? And in terms of the other drug evidence, Rakesha Johnson does not come into play until January of 2003. I understand she's charged in a conspiracy that spans a time frame, but these other drug transactions she's talking about, she's clearly not involved. They're not part of the conspiracy.
Why does that matter? I mean, does surely not every single member of the conspiracy has to be involved at every moment that's within the scope of the charge, right? Hmm.
True, but there's no evidence that McNeil was involved in these particular drug transactions either. And the fact that the volume of them, that he's doing it every other day.
Did Collins have another source?
There's no evidence that they came from McNeil. We don't know.
Well, okay. Is there any evidence he had any other source?
No, but I wouldn't expect his other sources to be developed in the evidence at trial. And certainly there's no evidence that these particular drugs came from Mr. McNeil. I think that's speculation and the volume of the transactions certainly prejudice him. If there are no other questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Pavlo, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement.